Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we are journeying 6 years after the aliens arrive into a residential state of the infected zone with the film Monsters. And I'm joined by two Matts. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you.
And Matt Walden, whereabouts are you, Matt?
I'm in Virginia. I just wrapped up the fall semester here at Virginia Commonwealth University in the School of the Arts, and just getting ready for the holidays here.
Now, Matt, this is a film that, interestingly, was released on iTunes as well as in cinemas. Did you see this in a cinema?
No, I actually saw it prior to its limited theatrical release, which I think it was released in New York and Los Angeles, I believe, here in the U.S., and maybe a couple other select cities. But prior to its release, it was available for a $10 rental on iTunes. And so I just rented it and watched it at my house.
And we're also joined by Matt G. Matt, how are you?
I'm fine and dandy, thank you.
Now, Matt, you're obviously here in the Sydney office with me. Matt, of course, is part of our FX PhD team. Did you see it in the cinema or on iTunes download?
I did. I was lucky enough to see it in the cinema before it went off. I think it goes off this week. But I don't know if it's available on iTunes in Australia. I think it's just cinema at the moment.
Right, right. So the thing about this film that makes it so interesting to us was a couple of things. Firstly, we are a big fan of the actual director of this film because we know him and he's a nice guy. And that's Gareth Edwards. And Gareth has actually taught over at FX PhD. He's a heck of a nice guy. But the thing that Gareth did that got us, first brought us him to our attention back in the day was he was a one-man band on a TV show, sort of a BBC thing. And at that time, he basically directed the production and did the visual effects work, and he did hundreds of visual effects shots just by himself, and we were stunned by this. And we did a story on FX Guide, and then we got to know him, and he, as I said, joined PhD, and lo and behold, he's come out now with this feature film. And Matt, this is also pretty much from a visual effects point of view a one-man band. Do you want to give us some of the sort of background for those people that don't know the film quite so well?
So yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned the earlier piece that that Gareth Edwards had done. It was, I believe, a BBC Discovery Channel co-production on Warriors, I think it was called, and it was the Attila the Hun piece.
Yep.
Is that the one you're referring to? You know, I teach here in Virginia at a university in an art school, and I teach computer graphics and 3D and 2D, and I, every semester for the better part of the last 3 or 4 years now since that came out, I've shown that piece in conjunction with one other thing, the Bloody Omaha short, which I think you might have seen as well. But I've shown those to my students to try to get them excited and inspired about the possibilities of things that they could do on their own if they were so inclined. But so I was really excited when I saw that he had gone and made a feature film. I actually had no idea that this was something that was in the works or something that was in the making until a trailer popped up for it. And even upon seeing the trailer, I didn't put two and two together. I didn't realize this was the same, that it was Gareth Edwards, the same guy who had made the Attila the Hun piece. You guys at FX Guide and John Montgomery did a really great interview with him where actually I garnered most of the information that I got was from John's interview with him. Where he talked about how he had for a long time been wanting to make a feature, and he had had some ideas about what he wanted to do. And he told a story, I believe, about how he had been out on a boat. I don't know if he was if this was in the UK or somewhere, but he had been watching some fishermen pull a fishing net in from the water. And he started thinking, if he were shooting that, how he could actually then take that image of this fishing net being pulled in back in to his studio and comp in, some kind of creature, like they were pulling up some kind of creature. And so it was sort of became, I think, the spark or the genesis for this idea of going and making a feature film entitled Monsters, that he would go and figure out a way to shoot and then do essentially what he had done on that earlier production and do all the post-production effects work, at least, pretty much solo.
I think the thing that is really interesting about this from now, just let's do the story first before we get to the visual effects, is that he acknowledges that he's not going to be able to do exactly what he wants if he was to write a really tight script and wanted to film that really tight script in a classic way that, say, Hitchcock always did. You know, it was completely storyboarded. That wasn't going to work. So it was much more like, if I managed to pick up things that were happening and then sort of weave them into my story, so I have a kind of rough story, but if I see, for example, in your case, the fisherman pulling in something, well, then maybe I could put a monster in the net and I wouldn't have to book a fishing boat, book actors to play the fisherman, work it all out. I would just kind of take that element and build it up. So many of the sequences in the film are a combination of the spontaneity of having that attitude and the spontaneity of having a really small crew, of which there was about six. So the lead actor and actress were absolutely professional actors, but a lot of the other people in the film weren't professional actors. He would just contact them and ask them if they'd be willing to be in it. And I think, Matt, there's a really great scene where he's filming people praying for ones, people that have been lost, basically. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Yep.
And that, I believe, was a Festival of the Dead, which happens in Mexico, where people remember loved ones that have gone. And he just filmed that, I think, and just, you know, converted it, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think he really took advantage of the improv of the two actors, who were actually a couple, so they already had a great dynamic right there. So, you know, shooting over 3 weeks in so many locations with a small crew, he just shot a lot of observational stuff and just came back to England and spent months cutting away, putting it together as a story. But he realized that, yeah, the story was going to have to drive the effects, and the effects could just be supplementary to whatever he shot, which, you know, knowing your balance is going to be get the story first and improve it with a couple of effects here and there. And obviously towards the end, there's some bigger effects, which, you know, you can't just wing that so much. I mean, he would have had to really plan the stuff near the end a lot more.
And I think the thing that's really interesting to me is that, and I'm going to get your opinion on this, Matt G, because this was actually shot in this indie style on Sony EX3 cameras. Now, we recently shot on the F3 Sony, and we had an EX3 as our making of behind the scenes camera, and it just wouldn't. Now, I think admittedly he had lens adapters on the front of it, so he could have, you know, changed to a more professional lens, but nevertheless, it seems extraordinary to me that he did this on an EX3. What did it look like projected?
It looked great projected, but, you know, again, the style of the film lent itself nicely to shooting on an EX3, and you had that kind of voyeuristic floating handy cam kind of feel to it, because you were supposed to be right there and intimate with the characters, so it worked for me. Every now and again, I thought some of the depth of field stuff was a bit too forced, you know, either just slightly soft, or I really want to see what is actually behind them to, you know, break out of this close plane of focus. But overall, I thought it worked really well.
And what did you think the image quality looked like, man?
Yeah, I mean, just watching it here, I mean, obviously I watched a somewhat compressed version of the finished thing, having just downloaded I think I just watched a standard definition version.
I downloaded the HD version, which was terrific.
Is that 720 or 1080?
Okay, so on Apple TV, it's 720.
Yeah.
But I've got to say, 720 to 1920 by 1080 up-res is way better than a effectively, you know, PAL or NTSC up-res, because, of course, you don't even have a basic 16 by 9 aspect ratio in a PAL or NTSC.
And, you know, I was just going to say, too, you know, it's funny for me just in that, you know, I can get interested in sort of image fidelity and all that stuff like any other.
Me too, man.
Yeah, right. Of course, right. But I will say that you know, what was really interesting to me watching this was that I don't know that I really cared. I don't know that I cared that much about how it was shot. I mean, I was really excited to find out how it was shot in terms of the logistics of how it was shot. Right, that it was a really small crew. That essentially it was, you know, Gareth himself shooting this whole thing using, you know, essentially prosumer cameras and equipment. And that was really exciting. The look that was achieved, the placement of where the camera was in the scene, the way in which everything sort of came together. I was totally involved in the story. And, you know, so I wasn't really... I don't know. I was fascinated to see the production value, and I thought he got an amazing amount of production value given I've heard a couple of different figures, but what I've heard the budget was, at least the shooting budget for this, and he got an amazing production value, and I think the two actors who also, by the way, did a really interesting podcast interview for the Creative Screenwriting magazine. I don't know if you happen to hear that, but they talked a lot about how they actually went about shooting scenes and how they dealt with character, which I thought was really fascinating as well. But even watching this, just I think in standard definition on my 23-inch cinema display here, I mean, I thought it looked beautiful. It was, I was totally engrossed in the story, and I don't feel like anything was lost for the fact that it was shot on, something less than epic, shall we say, right?
I saw some of the press clips, which were 720, and they looked good, but seeing it on projected off film, I think that really looked even better.
Well, the film, of course, in of itself would give it a film grain because of the
and the rolling of the print. Blacks just sits a lot nicer for some of those effect shots.
So it is actually a good thing sometimes to do that. Though,
do you guys know how the how that transfer to 35 was done? Did they go through a whole?
Yeah, I can tell you exactly how it was done. So he phoned up the post house that he was going to deliver the files to and said, "How do you want these files?" And they said, Cineon. And he went, "Okay, I can't see any button that says Cineon here in Premiere." And they said, "Okay, is there a button that says DPX?" And he went, "Yeah." They said, "Okay, press that." And he went, "Okay." And then he handed it over, and then they did the output to film.
That was the Post Republic who did. Great. I love the great.
I should point out, Gareth is not – he knows exactly everything he needs to know to get the shot done and no more. He is not a geek in the sense – he is a filmmaker, and he's like, "I want to do this so that I can make films, and if I'm not going to sit there and worry about pit death and stuff." Because he actually said he thought that it was going to be horrendous going from the world of video to the world of film. But in fact, the jump between HD, 1920 by 1080, and 2K is a pretty small leap, even as a statistical percentage just on pixel count. In the old days, it used to be a vastly dramatic difference when we were all just PAL NTSC guys and jumping to film res. Film res seemed like this awesomely high res thing. But I think these days, I mean, certainly in our sense, we do everything at FXPHD in HD, and then we tend to film everything in 4K. So 2K seems completely a reasonable format.
What is
to
he?
Work on.
What do you get when you get it off of that EX3 camera? Is it like 422 or?
No, it's normally 420. I can't actually tell you the. I could check whether what he was encoding to. He may have used the S-log, but I don't know. No, there is an S-log on the EX3. No, there isn't. So you don't even have S-log on the EX3. So it'd be 420. I should point out the camera equipment cost $15,000 and the budget came in at under $500,000 and it's already grossed several million dollars. So that's good news for him. I think the other thing is critically, it's been very well received. And certainly in Australia, the movie show last night, which is sort of one of the most respected, our Siskel and Ebert, if you like, rated it as one of the best films of the year. Not, the best, but certainly in, in the top 10. I think that...
I think it would have been more widely received if District 9 hadn't have come along last year.
Well, interesting you should say that. Let's have a slight detour into that, because before we get into the visual effects, I actually think it was, and I say this not trying to be nasty, but I actually think it was a monumental mistake to name the film Monsters, and because the trouble was naming it Monsters and having the kind of infected zone extraterrestrial poster stuff that they were doing. Everyone basically said, this is a UK Monsters. UK District 9. And, of course, it wasn't really a UK District 9. It was much more of a character journey with, oh, by the way, set in this post-apocalyptic world. But the word Monsters set it up that you thought they were primarily going to be dealing with the aliens. And, of course, District 9, when it came out, was considered low budget and cutting edge in, using sort of new techniques to add production value. And I think it got it too close to District 9. I'm sure somebody thought it was a good idea to get it close to District 9 because that would help sell it. But I think an audience really bucks when they have an expectation dashed. If you think you're going to see one thing and see something else, even if the something else is marvelous, you kind of feel a bit like, it wasn't what I wanted, expected. And those of us that had no preconceived ideas on the film, I think just loved it to death, but those that weren't expecting another District 9. And of course, when you're cutting the trailer, what do? They cut in all those kind of shots that make you feel like there's going to be tons of monster shots and it's going to be really scary. And it's not really that at all. So I do think that was a mistake, but hey, that's just me. It's my opinion.
Because it winds up being, it's so much more of a character study, really. I mean, wouldn't you say? I mean, it's not really in the end, an action movie by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, while there is, I think, you know, certainly some payoff here and there for some of the maybe expectations that people would go to see this film with, I do think that by and large, and actually I think that's one of the reasons why this movie works so well, is that it is... it's conscious of its own limitations, you know? And I think he even says that in the that interview with John Montgomery. He talks about how Gareth Edwards talks about how he, which I just thought is just, it's one of the most inspiring interviews I think I've ever heard on any of these shows. But I love when he was talking about how he looks at, he looked at a lot of, it totally resonated with me. He said he looked at all the films that sit on his shelf of who are his favorite filmmakers. And he goes and he looks back and he said that, you know, all the people who were his favorite filmmakers were the ones who, you know, maybe that we've all grown up with, but it was always their earlier films that really stuck with him. And he thought that part of that maybe was because, you know, when they were first starting out in their earlier projects, they didn't have as much access to, you know, resources. They didn't have access to as much money. And so they were making do with what they had. And he really took that sort of do-it-yourself mantra and that real kind of guerrilla style filmmaking. You know, what's Stu's book?
DV Rebel.
Yeah, DV Rebel kind of mindset, and really took it and ran with it. And I think this is the first, I really think this is the first film that I've seen in the modern era, in the current moment, that that really he's drawing from all the possible things that you could be utilizing and capitalizing on them, I think, to their fullest extent possible and executing at a really high level. I think this is the, I would say for my money, this is the best independent, low-budget science fiction movie with visual effects, you know, that I've seen in recent times. I mean, this blew my mind in so many ways, and I just think it's absolutely genius.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think one of the things that's really interesting about it, though, is you might at this point, if you didn't know what happened with the film, think, well, yeah, Gareth must be some kind of effects whiz genius. And he is obviously very, very talented. But what's, I think, telling about this film is to look at one tiny aspect of it, which is the compositing nature of the shots, and realize that most of the film had visual effects tracked into shots, and nearly all of them, bar a couple, were just 2D tracks. Mm. And I think this is really telltale sign, because normally you'd say, right, well, I want a 3D track every effect shot, and I'll build up a pipeline that has every shot 3D tracked, and then we'll put in 3D, blah, blah, blah. And he's gone, yeah, no, I don't really need to do that. I'll just do most of these as like a simple 2D track, the sort of thing that you would do in Premiere. Heck, you could do it in just anything. And only on a couple of occasions did he actually have to go to a 3D. And even then, his 3D tracking was, you know, sort of press one button. If he got a track out of it, he'd use it. And so instead of being somebody that goes, right, now I can do this because I have all these great tools and I can throw everything I can at it, he was like, what's the minimum amount I have to do to sell this shot? And I got to tell you, they work.
Well, and he was totally systemic, too, in the way that he went about doing it, right? I mean, he talks about in one of those interviews where he went through and he had a plan, and he basically had a, you know, basically a spreadsheet, and he figured out exactly how much time it was going to take to do each shot. And instead of focusing on like, oh, this is going to be the hardest shot, this is going to take me a really long time, or this is a hero shot, I really got to make this one kick ass. Like, instead of doing anything like that, what he did was he said, well, I'm just going to go through and I'm just going to rip through every shot that I've got to rip through, and I'm going to get everything up to the same level, right? And that level might be kind of shitty, right? Like, it might not look that great, but I'm going to get everything up to a certain level, and then I'm going to, you know, once everything is at one level, then I'm going to go back again and then go back again. And he slotted his time out. He worked in a super efficient and kind of nodal-based systemic way. I mean, he turned himself into a really highly efficient little production company, you know.
Just one point on that, which is really subtle. You said that he worked out how long everything was going to take, and then no, he didn't. Actually, what he did is he said, this is how much time I have to get the film out, divided it by the number of shots, and said, this is how long I'm allowed to spend on each shot, and then just sat down and said, right, well, imagine this shot's ripped out of my hands in 5 hours. Cripes, what can I get done in 5 hours? And then move to the next shot.
I mean, I heard that and I thought, God, you know, that's a great lesson for so many visual effects producers that I know. I mean, just that mentality, that mindset of just saying, like, this is the way to work. This is a way to get stuff to get a high volume of work out of a single individual artist in an interesting, I don't know, I was totally fascinated by his whole MO. I think, I really think it was brilliant.
Yeah, with 250 effect shots to churn out in a year, you know, Gareth's obviously an awesome After Effects operator and Photoshop guy. Mm. I mean, he did that great After Effects course at FX PhD, and that was back on the Attila the Hun stuff. But yeah, no, he obviously can't go around teaching himself whole new programs to get it all done in that time. He has to get it out and get it released at a certain time.
Yeah, I've got to say, I think if we just want to start getting critical now on the effect shots, I think we need to now switch gears and say, while we, you know, say wholeheartedly we're not worthy and an astonishing job doing 250 shots in the time that he had and stuff, I think to a certain extent we now need to just discuss those shots without the caveat of, but he did them by himself in his bedroom. We should just judge them for their own sake. And so I do this as a friend of Gareth's. I apologize in advance. But I just think that's, you know, fair's fair. We should judge by what we see on the screen and not by, you know, knowing what a great guy he is. So I would say that I think the least successful shots for me were the actual monster tentacle stuff. I know that he had a really clever way of doing them by using rope pre-things and then turning gravity off and having them kind of wave around in the air. But while I thought the lighting and the way that he composited the monsters was great, the legs did feel a bit to me like monsters done of old, where you've got floppy legs on strings that are kind of waving around without intent. Then, in other words, the tentacle bits of the monsters didn't feel personality or purpose driven. And I don't know many animals that wave their limbs around. I think maybe a chimp might, but you know, most animals don't expel any energy that they don't have to. And so it would be, to me, if I was looking at that shot just with a super critical eye, I'd say, yeah, just waving tentacles around is, in the water, they kind of do it for movement and balance and orientation. But in the air, I felt like, why are they just waving their tentacles around?
I liked the weight of the creatures in the wider shots when you see them walking around. You know, they move. They reminded me of the striders. I think they're called striders in Dark Crystal. They had that kind of walking. I like the weight they had when they walked. But you're right, the mass of that versus the weird little tentacle things going through the petrol station, just, yeah.
It's just, you know, like there's something much more threatening when it feels to be motivated by purpose. And obviously the classic of that is like a cat. And I'm talking like a wild cat now, like a leopard kind of thing, where, you know, they're poised and sprung and you just have this sense of like economy of motion. And when there's no need to move, they don't. At the other end, it's kind of goofier just to wave your arms around and flop around. And I just didn't feel like... in terms of character design, like I thought they were really lit well, and I thought they were integrated this idea of the kind of phosphorescent stuff, but it was the least believable, just from a sort of story visual effects point of view, that you'd have these big creatures just sort of, whoa, I'm just going to hang around here.
Looking for TVs to suck power from.
Can I suck your brain out? Yeah. I don't know.
Did you say Thunderbirds in there?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would concur. I mean, I think, you know, that's certainly something that, you know, doesn't really, you know, as you were saying, I mean, it doesn't really detract from the film, but I think it's something that, you know, could have been better. I actually thought there was one shot that appears in the, at least the US theatrical trailer. There's one shot in there that is really tough, and I don't think it looks quite the same in the finished film. And I don't know if it was, I can't imagine he had a temp, but maybe he did, I don't know. But it's a shot in the, I believe it's in the gas station convenience store near the end of the film, and it's the the female lead. And she's hiding, and there's a tentacle that comes sort of between these two white sort of laminate counters. And there's that one tentacle shot in particular stood out as one where I thought the lighting was wrong, and the it didn't feel integrated into the scene at all. It felt really just very A over B in the comp, and that was one thing that... It was, of all the shots in the film, it was one that stuck out like a sore thumb for me. But yeah, the overall animation of the tentacles waving around and stuff, it's a subjective thing, you know. I don't. It's hard to say what else it could have been, given the design of the creatures that he went with.
Yeah, you needed that tension to happen in the petrol station, and you know, you can't really fit one of those monsters inside it. And to have it rip off the roof would have just been.
Yeah, no, I just feel like you get more character when you have. Well, I just. You know, I refer to real animals because the only thing I can refer to, obviously, is their aliens. Who's to say what's right or wrong with an alien? But I just thought, why would a character do that? Like, what's the reason for it? If it was, it's blind and seeking out its space through feeling, then again, I just don't feel like it would be waving around quite so much. And he's got to be more purposeful and cautious. It felt like, did feel a fish out of water, which I guess is a good thing, like an alien in a different world. But yeah, let's flip gears the other way. Was there any shots that you thought just were remarkably effective?
I thought the little pods with the flashing lights and the trees and all that, they looked interesting and I think were pulled off really nicely. Simple and, yeah. And look, so many sign replacements here, there and everywhere.
Yeah.
What about you, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I thought those were great. I like the big hero shot of the airplane in the water. I thought was really neat, and I really did enjoy. Although, you know, there's something about it that it's I think there's some perspective problems that I had with it a little bit. But I did like the big wall at the end. You know, when it's sort of the weird conceit where they're sitting on the pyramid and they come down off the pyramid and then they can see the wall, which is like the border fence that's been erected as a way to try to keep this infection contained, right? And I like the ambition of something like that. I thought it was, you know, and it's such a fun sort of 2D kind of comp. I remember when they were doing Tim Alexander was doing comps for Contact way back when, the Robert Zemeckis movie, right? And one of the things they did was, I think it's New Mexico where they have that big radar array with the radio antenna. And Tim went in and he actually, you know, placed a whole bunch of additional radar on the horizon. And it was just a 2D comp, you know, but it was one of those things that when you add so many more things or you increase something like that, where there's more scale in the case of something like that wall. I love effects like that where they're, you know, that they're not really that hard to do, but they can have a really enormous impact on the sort of the feeling that you get as you watch the scene unfold.
Yeah, I think that, I think you're right. I think it's like a classic matte painting, right, where you just want that kind of establishing shot. I've got to say, the stuff that I really liked was shots, and I guess I covered them in the interview I did with him on FX Guide TV for this reason, that they thought they were really simple and effective. They're in the water, they're going along, and there's just sort of ruins as they're driving or motoring up the river. And these ruins were just 2D elements played in the back of shot. And interestingly, when he was filming them, he would sort of film them with air to the right to put that ruin in. And then when he was comping, he'd sort of cut the shot right before her hair would kind of go over it, because he knew that would be just too hard, or at least too hard in the time he had available. So you got these lovely kind of natural shots of people looking out and being oblivious to the ruin, because of course it wasn't there for the actress, who didn't know she was even being filmed, and for the audience made it just really subtle. And but in the background you had this lovely kind of overgrown ruin type feel, and a bunch of those shots peppered through I thought added such production value. And they didn't have to be more than they were, you know. It would have been easy to see that and then have somebody require a section of it to fall over or to do something much more complex. But just having these things there, and the one that we covered also in that FX Guy TV was the bloody hands on the side of the boat, where he actually, you know, went and put fake blood on his hands and stuck it on his bath and then photographed his bath and then comped it on. And I've got to say, that gets back to that old world sort of vibe of, you know, doing visual effects with a bit of chewing gum and sticky tape and a coat hanger. And it just felt like that in a digital age, and I love that. But even without knowing how he did it, I just felt that river sequence had a lot of production value and interest, because he was just subtly dotting stuff up in a way that that really gave it power. And just before that, also in the film, when they were driving and you'd look over at destruction, and they'd he'd put things in the distance. Those are the shots I thought just tended to really build up mood and tension. And yet they weren't overplayed. They, you know, he didn't like, look at me, I'm going to have a close-up of the map painting because I spent so much bloody time on it. It was always just in the background as part of the environment. And they worked so well, I thought.
He designed so much stuff. You think about 250 shots, you're not really seeing too many assets reused. So, you know, he's designing all those buildings and the look of, you know, the rust and decay on the boats and the creatures. There's a lot of design work going in. And if it's just a one-man band doing all that stuff, it's
yeah, there was another great shot too, where there's that like a mule drawn cart or something with some guys sitting on it, and it has like a jet engine or a rocket engine or something on it that says like Air Force or NASA on it or something like that, right? That goes by.
It's interesting. Also, the eye skyline, sorry, the eye to the sky eye line of the jets flying by. I don't know if you heard him saying that, but he was saying that quite often the actors wouldn't have a realistic eye line because, you know, when you're not looking at something for real, you tend to sort of flit around with your eyes. And so he'd be like, right, how am I going to solve that? The jet's meant to be here. Now it needs to be here, depending on where they're looking. Jet can't move that fast. Oh, I know. I'll just put two jets in. Put a jet in here where it works with looking over here. When they glance over there for no apparent reason, I'll just put another jet over there. And wow, that's what you kind of miss, I think, sometimes with directors who are not from visual effects, because they'll say, well, could you just change their eye line? And you'd be like, what? You're like, well, can you just do digital eyes and change their eye, you know, make it look like they're over there? And it's all going to be hard work. And all you need them to be, in the way that many great directors were, as you say, at the start of their career, much more adaptive and say, oh, that's okay, we can just have a second one over there. You know, that's just a valid thing to do.
And the sound design, it really helps sell those card solutions. I mean, especially so many helicopters, you know, just throw one of those in and the sound effect and you buy that card.
Do you want to recount that story of what happened with the sound on when they got to the landing with the cow and the, you know, they were...
The scene where they land and they hear a weird, freaky noise and they turn around, there's lots of cows around.
Yeah.
I don't remember the story.
Oh, okay. So that actually happened. They actually got out and just heard a weird sound, and there was cows making this weird noise. And he said in the interview, which I thought was terribly funny, that, of course, in a really big production, unit would have gone in there and cleared all the cows out because they're going to be filming, right? He would never have been in a situation that he as a director would have experienced that, because in a big feature film, someone would have gone in, made sure the area was contained, pre-dressed it all.
Maybe got brought their own special cows in for the right cow
noise. Only if that was in the yeah, script, right? Sure. No cow in the script. Clear the cows out, whereas he was saying the way they were working, they just turned up, they heard this horrible sound and realized it was a cow and thought, hey, we'll just build that into the story, even though it's stopping us from moving on and doing what we expected to do today, we'll just add that. And I think it's a great funny scene in the film. Yeah. And it's that kind of spontaneity that you can take advantage of when you're in this mode of being very adaptive and flexible. And I think there's no way you can get around the fact that you couldn't work your effects like this, or you couldn't work the edit like this, unless you've got a director that's on that page. If your director has that kind of, I've got a vision in my head and I want to see that on the screen mentality, you're dead.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Mike, you, when we started off talking, you said that at the very beginning of this conversation, you said something about how, and maybe you're getting there, I don't know, but you said something about how this, the way in which this film was made, the way in which he worked, that for some people, this was really scary for a lot of people, this idea of working in this way and what this meant for films. I was curious what you meant by that.
Well, there are some directors that don't like the idea that it's, not just that it's collaborative, but it's collaboratively adaptive to this level. And so they desire a level of control to get a vision on the screen. And what I think is sort of frightening about this way of working is this idea that, well, you're not going to get exactly what you want, and you shouldn't even be wedded to any particular thing. We should just see what we can do and adapt accordingly. And I've seen directors sort of say, well, we're just going to have to fix it because I don't want it like that. And, you know, in a real sense, you say, well, you can do that, but you're just going to spend a lot of your money getting exactly what you want. Whereas if you went with what the environment and life is throwing up for us, we could get a whole bunch more of stuff. And so this means that if you work in that sort of Gareth way, you can produce a film for $500,000 that goes on to gross millions of dollars, and you can make major feature films. And if you're the director that isn't so comfortable with the technology, that's kind of annoying, because you feel like, well, A, I couldn't do that because I couldn't do 250 effects myself. And B, when I try working with people that want to work like that, I'm required to not direct. I have to kind of hand over to them because they'll tell me what I can or can't do. And I think that's what I mean by that. It's if you are digitally uncomfortable with visual effects, and I'll give you an example, and I'm going to change the names to protect the innocent, but I was recently talking to a production company about a director, and this director was all like, I want to keep it real, I don't want to do all this visual effects stuff, and I'm going to shoot it authentically and blah, blah, blah. And they took this production down a route which I could understand to a point. I can understand why they were saying all that. The trouble was that they introduced so many problems that the solution required the exact opposite of what they said. They required enormous amounts of tech, enormous amounts of high-tech VFX to get around the problem. They basically produced an environment where getting the 3D done that they needed to get done was almost impossible. One of the most difficult things. It'd be a bit like you wanted to shoot green screen and then somebody said, yeah, but it's absolutely essential that we have somebody in a green suit in front of it because I want to keep it real. It was that stupid, right? And I'm using an analogy. It wasn't what it was. It was, but it made the 3D tracking almost impossible. And of course, what they actually wanted was a look. And they figured the way to get the look was to use old technology. Well, I understand that at that level, but at some point you need a director that's open to saying, you understand that, but it is much better to hold our image quality, hold out and get all the modern tools that we can deploy on this and then make it look like the look you want. Then, well, maybe a better analogy than my green screen and green suit would be to say, I want this to look like a 1920s, 30s piece of news footage, so I'll shoot it with a 1920s camera. And it's like, well, yes, that is kind of true into a sense, but that's going to blow a lot of budget with us having to process in the old style to deal with all the imperfections and problems that that causes. And it's the director just isn't open to hearing that. They don't want to hear that it's much better to shoot on a digital camera and degrade the image later once they've solved all of the technical problems that this director wants solved.
But who's producing and shooting these things? I mean, that's when you bring on a crew, you're bringing on people with experience, and you know, you have to be listening to these people if they're saying, you know what, I just don't think it's going to work for the quality and the cost.
You know, I mean, who hasn't been in that meeting where you've tried talking to the director and they just don't want to hear it? And
well, I guess
I
would say too, though, that like I think there's two things going on there. Like, and one of them could be what you're describing. It could be literally just like an insecurity or sort of an ignorance of the fact that there's maybe a better way of doing the thing that they want. But I also do think, and this is going to maybe sound a little bit crazy, but I do think that on some level, you know, when we're thinking about film, film is an art form, and that if there is a reason why an artist, even if it seems like a jackass, stupid reason that's going to cause a whole host of problems for people down the road, if there's some reason why that artist wants to use or feels that it's important methodological yeah, way that they need to use a particular tool for some specific reason creatively. I mean, it's an ephemeral thing. Like when you get
into
an
artist. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just not buying into that. I actually, I understand where you're coming from, but I also am willing to call crap on that because I swear to God, there are people. No, but I mean, here's the thing. Like that sounds really good. You don't get to make a film like Monsters if you take that approach. You know, like I'm sorry, but as an actor, what I really need from this is X, Y, and Z. Okay, well, that's a different film then. You know what I mean? Like it's
probably like something that's less. It's yeah. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I'm sort of playing devil's advocate, right? Like, and what I'm just sort of saying is that I think in a less collaborative medium, maybe you have that a greater degree of freedom to do that. But
My problem is that sometimes the director just isn't very collaborative, and they aren't willing to any of these directors we're talking about, like Spielberg, whatever. Jaws, whatever. You know, you can't just say, well, I have to film the shark and you have to fix it later. You say, well, okay, I need to shoot from the shark's point of view because the shark isn't working. And that ends up with Jaws. And that is what I'm saying. And just insisting on going down a path because I feel as an artist it's going to give me the right method and performance is really arrogant. And I've got to say, like, this is what I'm getting at. I don't think you get Monsters from that. And I also think it is really hard to talk to some directors. And if I've told this anecdote on the show before, but I once got thrown off a film And it wasn't because I was being a complete smartass, though when I recount this story, you'll say that I was. But we had to make a monster. And we had to make our monster in a swamp. And the idea was that this swamp monster would be attacking and killing people during the course of the low-budget film that we were making. Low-budget film, right? And so I was like, well, we can do a lot. We really can. But it's going to be really tight doing all this stuff. So it'd be helping us a lot if we didn't do a lot of revisions. And what I was thinking, and so I say this at a pre-pro meeting, I say it'd be really good if we had, for example, where it's coming from. Like, is this a cornered beast that is, you know, hurt and wounded and reacting because it just feels like it's got nowhere to run and it's cornered? Or is this like, this is my swamp, I am Mother Nature, I am everything standing proud and tall, come into my, you know, area and you will deal with me? Or is it like from outer space and it doesn't even understand what's going on and it kind of accidentally kills people because it wonders what happens if you pull the head off a human and, oh, look, it stopped moving. Oh, well, I'll just drop it. And is it, could it be maybe that this character is like normally completely happy but just has sensed a threat, like a mother protecting a child, and so what it's trying to do is be very, very protective but lash out just to push them back? And I said that to the director almost like that. I said, so which, you know, like, would you say the monster is? And he went, yeah, good point, all of that. And then the meeting moved on. And I was like, next thing I got a note was that we don't really want you on set anymore because the director feels like he's not, you haven't really got his vision. And I'm like, oh, motherfucker.
You had all of them.
Well, but my point was, like, this director, you know, he had no idea. And that he found, I mean, obviously me not to be the guy to work with. And I accept that. Okay, I obviously wasn't a good fit for him. It's his film. He can do anything bloody well likes. But my point is, it's really hard sometimes to push a director. But if a director could have done that, if the director could have said, look, this is a wounded animal that is reacting, then I could have, as a supervisor, told the animator how I felt he was succeeding with the shot in terms of where he'd placed the hand of the character or how the leg was or what the stance of the character was. Because I'd have the director's character framework upon which to interpret the character animation that was being done by the character animator. But take that away, and is this what the director wants? I don't know. I mean, it looks cool. Let's show it to him. I've no idea, right?
In this example, like, this director isn't articulating what it is that they want. They're not, or they haven't even thought about what do they want in terms of that level of character in their own minds, you know. And it's like, so at that point, you know, you're sort of dealing with, it's a whole another problem right there, right?
But this guy was like just not wanting to in any way be collaborative. He was like, I'm going to, you know it when I see it kind of thing. And like, that's why you run up these $1 million bills, you know, that you can
But you know, it makes me think, like, while you're telling that story, it makes me think of some of the other things that I've seen happen on huge budget films with incredibly collaborative filmmakers. And this is the kind of thing that happens in big budget effects films all the time. And I hope it's happening less and less, although it has been a while since I've worked on a huge film. But, you know, where they're scrambling to get as many shots as they can, and everybody wants to break for lunch or for the end of the day or whatever, and they need one more, you know, critical green screen shot, and they go and they set up the green screen. I mean, there's a hilarious mock Cinefex cover that was made back while they were working on King Kong while I was there, and one of the compositors grabbed a frame of Naomi Watts and swinging on a vine in front of a huge stage covered with green screen material, and the only place where there was no green screen material was where they were swinging on the vine, right? And it was like this joke about how, you know, everybody's, of course, trying to do their best, but at the same time becomes an issue and money becomes an issue, and there's not time to get everything moved around, get everything done. And this is an incredibly collaborative team of people working on, you know, in that instance, on that project. But there were still so many instances where there wasn't time. There wasn't time and energy and enough put forward to be able to actually execute the green screens or whatever it might have been to get, and this happens all the time, right, on big effect shows where there's the time isn't allotted for what becomes really the most difficult and technical part of the filmmaking, which becomes the post-production visual effects work, and the time isn't allotted, and so in the end it does wind up costing infinitely more money, you know, but maybe for a host of different reasons.
But isn't this where Gareth wins? This is where Gareth wins, right?
It's his biggest achievement,
right?
Time management and knowing what he can and can't do.
And Gareth doesn't say, you know, well, I didn't, you know, I didn't worry about that at all. Or I didn't think about that, or I'll solve it in post. He's like literally going, well, do I need that? I don't think I need that. Okay, I'll move on. What I really need from this is X. I mean, he did, for example, have people holding things up to try and give them, you know, or that left tree on the right, that is going to be a ship. Look at that. You know, he did know what he wanted, and he did have no problem in communicating that with the visual effects supervisor or the visual effects team because they were the same guy. And so he's, you know, one of the huge advantages that you've got in this loop here is you don't have a director that just says, well, I want an aircraft carrier there. And you go, but why would there be an aircraft carrier there? And it's like, well, I don't think you're getting my vision. No, okay, sure, we'll put an aircraft carrier there. And then everyone goes, that was the stupidest shot with the aircraft carrier. And the poor visual effects artist is going, well, yeah, but what was I meant to do? And I'm saying that I don't think it's easy as an artist or as a supervisor to talk to a director because they just don't want to hear. And they, no matter how, I mean, maybe you could do it much better than I did. I'm sure you probably could. I'm sure, Matt, you are very good at telling a director what is sensible and not. But I found that there are some directors that are really open to it. And look, I worked on Red Dwarf and I had a huge technical problem, massive technical problem. And I tried explaining it to the director and he was like, no, fine, I'll just fix it. And I was like, no, you can't. I've told the story before. And he was like, no, really, I've got to solve this because it's a continuity problem. Blah, blah. He goes, no, I'll just add a line that it changed. And I was like, what? He said, yeah, I'll just get one of the actors to do a voiceover line that says it changed and then it'll be fine. Then it'll be funny. And I was stunned because he was just completely in a good place and there was great working relationship, and he just immediately just went, yeah, I can get you out of that hole.
Well, yeah, that's the idea. By changing the script, right? Yeah.
But if he hadn't been like that, which he absolutely was, if he hadn't been like that and been like, well, I don't care, it's, you know, you just have to fix it, we'd have spent a man month fixing that one problem. He fixed it with one character line. Awesome.
I'm looking forward to seeing what Gareth's going to do next, and I hope it's going to be a bigger budget film that leads to bigger, better things. And I think the VFX house that will work with him on whatever next projects he's got will be so incredibly lucky to have a VFX savvy director who obviously knows the process and is sympathetic to what is required to get it across the line.
But why are there not more visual effects supervisors directing?
Well, you know, that's, I think, a really interesting subject. I mean, I think there are actually quite a few people who are directing films who came and who have directed films who came out of visual effects. Although I would say, without mentioning any names, I would say that I actually think this film is probably one of the best films that I've seen from a former, you know, computer visual effects person, digital visual effects person. I mean, I look at some of the other kinds of films that are being put together and put out, and while they might have bigger budgets and they certainly have more elaborate effects, they're basically big studio pictures that have the sense that they've been made kind of by a committee. You know, they don't really, there's no real singular vision at work in the way that I think there's a real artist's vision, a real auteur's vision in Monsters. You know, I think that's something that Gareth brings to the screen that I think a lot of other visual effects artists who have made the transition from visual effects to the director's chair, I haven't seen that. I have not seen that done successfully. I've tried to think of an example. You know, probably the best example I could think of that, you know, some people will say they hate this movie, I'm sure, but would be Doug Trumbull's Brainstorm. You know, I feel like that's like it's about as close as it gets. But I can think of so many. I like that film too, but I can think of so many other all the big show scan stuff, and that's really cool to see. But I could think of so many other films of visual effects supervisors and visual effects artists who some of who I know and, you know, who I like, you know, friends of mine. Don't take any offense here, but I feel like they the films that they wind up going and making. And maybe they get to make more than one film too, and it's great. I mean, I applaud, you know, their success. I think it's fantastic. But I'll be honest, I don't think they're making good movies. You know, and again, that's a subjective thing. But you know, I'd be hard pressed to find a lot of real cinephiles who would disagree.
Yeah, I mean, just because you can blow up buildings and you've done it before doesn't mean you should. Whereas, you know, Gareth's realized just tell a simple story and keep the effects. Mm-hmm. You know, complementing the story rather than dominating.
Well, he says that he wanted to do visual effects so he could make films.
Yeah, he was doing the visual effects for incredibly low rates to build his name up as a director, and that's when he finally got the break in with the Warriors series, directing the Attila the Hun one. You know, finally got that step up doing the VFX and directing and got trusted with bigger projects. So.
I've got to say, for myself, there was a point in my career, where I actually said to myself, I don't want to direct because I actually really like visual effects for its own sake. So I should totally say that there's nothing wrong with not wanting to direct and doing visual effects, because visual effects is an end to itself, and rightfully so. Like cinematography, right? Like, not every cinematographer needs to want to go on and become a director. But I
think it's interesting the explosion in visual effects that took place, at the sort of early 1990s when it really exploded and took off, and you started seeing companies like ILM go from, you know, a couple hundred employees to like a couple thousand employees, right? And other companies opening and springing up. I think it was an interesting time, and it continues to be a really interesting time, in that you have now, there is a pathway for a student, you know, whether it's a student at a university or a student going to like FX PhD classes or whatever, there is a pathway for a student to go from the classroom to a feature film job, you know, making a fairly, you know, decent salary in the film business. And that avenue was much more difficult 30 years ago, I think, than it is today. And so definitely, I think that, you know, it makes sense that there would be a lot more, certainly there are people, like you say, Mike, who are interested in visual effects for visual effects sake, and that's fantastic. But I think there's also a lot of people who go to film school and are really interested in filmmaking, and they see a path and they see a way into the film business through the visual effects, which is sort of a curious path to take. But I think certainly that's the path I found myself on and still have been on, you know. And I think that's a lot of students that I have, that's their interest too. They might be interested in filmmaking, but they're like, I think maybe I could study effects and get really good at working digitally. And I think it's an interesting time. It's very different than what it was like, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. It's a totally different kind of apprenticeship that goes on for filmmakers.
Well, even the simplest film these days has, like, you know, a drama or a rom-com. There's 200 VFX shots in there. I mean, you write a script, there's already 200 effect shots in there from the beginning, whether or not people realize
that. Drive-in car, right? There's yeah. 50.
Yeah.
It's. I think people need to understand it's not going away. It's only going to get worse. We're looking at these face replacements happening on these bigger end films. It's 10 years' time. This will probably be a button in flame.
You know? Don't you think that that the things like what Gareth Edwards did here with Monsters? Don't you think we're going to see more of this? I mean, I feel like this is going to be. I feel like this is just the beginning. Like, I think there's going to be more and more films like this. You know, hopefully. We'll be able to separate the wheat from the chaff or whatever, but like I just feel like
I don't think we've solved distribution though, because I think the problem Gareth solved one problem with this film that we haven't touched on, which is he got distribution. He actually got it into cinemas. I think the possibility of making a film like this now is not as much of a technical hurdle or a financial hurdle. It's getting that film picked up and having some money to market it and then getting an audience to see it. That is going to become the biggest challenge. And you go to Sundance, you see a whole lot of really good films. Very few of them will find a theatrical release, and those that do won't stay at the theater for very long. And I think that's a big challenge.
That's why I like Gareth's iTunes release at the same time. A friend of mine's making a film called The Tunnel, and you know, you buy a frame of it online for $1, but come early next year, you can just download the film for free. It's being released on torrents everywhere. And just that approach has already gotten him a lot of studio interest in the film.
Edward Burns, the New York filmmaker, his last two or three films, I think, he released simultaneously theatrically and on iTunes as well, which I think was an interesting... I'd love to see some of the numbers, you know, in terms of what kind of return do they actually get? Are they making?
I mean, if you can make a film for like under $1 million bucks, you don't need to have a lot of box office. You just need enough so that you can get some DVD sales.
Yeah,
and you can easily make your money back. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that the people invested in Gareth's film would get their money back more than you would if you invested in a $70 million film, which I think would be really dangerous to see your money back.
Did he secure the $500,000 financing before they went on location?
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah, no, basically.
And that was
to a meeting
through the studio, what was the distribution company called?
It was through that and a presentation that he made, and they were like, if you can make it for this, how long will you need to finish it? And he gave them a number, and they went, great.
Right.
And it happened all very quickly.
Those Vertigo films, I think.
But, you know, this is the thing, though. It's like you can make money. Like $1 million sounds like a lot of money. Obviously, it's more than $500,000 by the time you add in marketing and stuff.
Is it Vertigo that put the money to?
Yeah. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I think it was Vertigo Films.
I've been told. Can I tell you a funny story? So, so there's a guy in the film who I think is terrific called Mario, who's the ticket sales guy. You know, the guy they're talking to about getting a ticket, and then they
for the ferry. Yeah,
yeah. So this is just a non-actor, and so Gareth's in a presentation in somewhere or other. I'm going to say Cannes, but you know, some really interesting place. And he's saying, God, I really just loved Mario. His great performance. And I just hope that somehow, I've got no way of knowing if he's ever even knows that we finished the film. Everyone was really great. We told him it was an alien invasion film and everyone was just happy to do it. And he was really happy. And I just thought he was so great. And anyway, I just don't know even knows if he knows that this is the film that he's in. And it was all done above boards. There were releases, all this kind of stuff for anyone that's listening. But anyway, this is what Gareth says in this thing, which goes on YouTube, right? So a guy called Jose, who is a member of FXPHD, sees this on YouTube and, of course, knows that we know him. So he contacts me to contact Gareth and says, that guy, Mario, he's actually in Costa Rica and we know him. Like, he's a friend of the family. And if Gareth's cool with it, I'll show him the film. Gareth's like, wow. It's just like, I just think this is like small world, right? This is like an Englishman gets contacted by an Australian because someone in Costa Rica has watched something that he's said in Cannes. And that's how small the world is. And I think that's indicative of why Monsters gets made. The technology is just moving to a point that, I mean, that just blows my mind. I talk about 6 degrees of separation. You shoot in an incredibly small village in a coastal area somewhere, and sure enough somebody knows that guy, and not only that but knows that somebody who knows the director, and it's wow. So anyway, I just thought it was funny, and of course Gareth was incredibly happy to hear about that, and I've since put them in touch, and I think he's sending him something, so it's all happening. But it's great, nothing to do with me, I was just the middleman, but I just thought it was very funny. Hey, we should wrap up at this point because I have to go to Korea and you have to do other things, I'm sure. Matt G., where can people find you?
I'm usually loitering over at fxphd.com or, somewhere in the back room of fxguide.com.
And Matt, what about you?
You can always find me on mattwallen.com or on Twitter at mattwallen.
Now, I should point out that we're going to be doing Tron as our next film. We're really looking forward to this. Obviously, a major visual effects film. Very different, obviously, from what we're seeing here. Not original material in the sense it's a sequel or for a classic film that influenced so many of us years and years ago. And, of course, also a big Hollywood Disney film. But a very interesting film, and we're looking forward to talking about it immensely when it comes out. We've also got some stories coming up on FX Guide about that. We've really appreciated this year, everybody being with us. We expect to get the Tron show out just before Christmas. That's our hope, cross fingers. But I just want to thank Todd. Todd Shilton is our producer with Matt here in the studio. And these two guys do an awesome job in pulling everything together. And it's no exaggeration to say that without Todd and without Matt, thank you, Matt, we would actually have no show. I certainly wouldn't be ever corralled around a microphone often enough to keep it going because my schedule just seems berserk. Nor would we have a show without people like you, Matt. So thank you for giving up your time.
My pleasure.
But thank you guys for listening, because honestly, the show is, we know, incredibly popular. It's grown a lot this year, as has our other podcasts. And, you know, we understand that you guys have a very tight time schedule and you devote time to listening to the show and sending us information and emails, and when we've got stuff wrong, correcting us, and we appreciate all of that. We really do. And without you guys, we simply wouldn't do the podcast. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for making 2010 a great year. We'll try and fit in one more show just before Christmas, which is Tron, and then, of course, we'll be back in the new year. And there's a bunch of really cool, interesting stuff coming up and happening at FX Guide in the new year. So until then, I'll say goodbye, and thank you guys again for being with us on the show, and thank you for listening. See ya.